Yesterday, my wife Carrie and I enjoyed spending the afternoon with some friends at the Hobby Center for the musical Memphis. The lead male character is a fictionalized version of real-life disc jockey Dewey Phillips, who lived in Memphis, Tennessee. And he was a pioneering DJ introducing black music to a wider and whiter audience on the radio. Down the road and beyond the scope of the musical, he would become famous as the first person to play a recording of Elvis Presley on the air. That young Elvis would be taken around town by this white man to meet African-American club owners and music stars. In the musical, set in the segregated South of the 1950s, one of the things that's painful to watch throughout the whole thing is the racism that provides tension within the story. And if that's not enough, however, there is a jarring dissonance in Memphis between Christianity as it's meant to be, like the image in the book of Revelation of a great multitude that no one can number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages standing before the throne of God, and notions about how good Christian white people are supposed to act in a society where a perversion of Christianity reinforced the walls between races. I've been wrestling with that dissonance in my family tree over the last 6 months or so. As some of you heard me share during a recent faith forum on reconciliation, my wife strongly suggested to me last summer that I should find something else to do other than checking the national news constantly in my spare time. And I thought, okay, all right. So one night when I was having trouble falling asleep, I decided that it might be a fun distraction to explore the past through Ancestry.com. And it was fun to discover in my wife's family tree a delightful scoundrel who was a prisoner at the Jamestown colony, and some Unionist hellraisers in my own family tree who broke out of jail multiple times in Confederate North Carolina. Wow, history can be fun. But I didn't expect to meet Daniel Hackney Jr., my great-great-great-grandfather. He became a Baptist deacon in 1833 in Chatham County, North Carolina. After the Civil War, he was licensed to preach in 1866 and ordained as a minister of the gospel in 1871. And he, too, was a Unionist throughout his political career as an elected representative in North Carolina's General Assembly during the 1840s and 1850s. But Hackney was a pro-slavery Unionist, believing, like many conservative politicians of his day, that secession would ultimately be the surest and quickest path to the destruction of the institution of slavery. So I guess we can all agree that he was right about that one thing, at least. The 1860 United States federal census included slave schedules that reveal the fact that Hackney owned slaves. And I have a copy of it right here. It doesn't include their names because they're simply counted as property under his name. 14 in total, most of them children, including a one-month-old baby. 13 were black, one was biracial. There were 8 males and 6 females. None were fugitives, and together they lived in 3 slave houses. The dissonance between that harsh reality and Hackney's complete devotion to the work of Baptist churches after the war, without seeming to regret the past, is simply astonishing. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That sentence introduces what we Christians traditionally refer to as the Ten Commandments, which we've been reciting at the beginning of our liturgies each Sunday throughout this season of Lent. But the Bible itself refers to this collection as the Ten Words, or Decalogue. And interestingly, in the Jewish tradition, that sentence is neither an introduction nor a prologue, but stands alone as the first word. So as an aside, yes, there's more than one way to divide up this familiar text into 10 parts. There's a traditional Jewish way. There's the way that our tradition and certain other Christian traditions add that sentence and say, and add to it, thou shalt have no other gods before me. And there are other Christian traditions that add the next part to the first word, no other gods before me and no idols. So you can count the Ten Commandments different ways. So it's not as simple as people often make it out to be. Back in 2006, Lynn Westmoreland, a member of the United States House of Representatives from Georgia, co-sponsored a bill that would have declared the Ten Commandments to be fundamental principles and the cornerstones of a fair and just society, and required them to be clearly displayed in the United States Capitol. He believed people needed to understand and to respect these commandments. But when Westmoreland was interviewed about this, he stumbled when asked, what are the Ten Commandments? Don't murder. Don't lie. Don't steal. I can't name them all. Now, to be fair, as my wife told me, that's like asking most Americans to name the seven dwarfs from Snow White. You might come up with sleepy, bashful, and sneezy while completely unable to recall Grumpy, Happy, Dopey, and Doc. The issue with Westmoreland wasn't the fact that he stumbled. It was the sanctimonious way that he wanted to impose this on everyone without fully embracing it himself. And make no mistake about it, these 10 words are spoken to Jews and, by extension, to Christians who accept the Hebrew Bible. And they presume a redeemed and worshiping community. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That first word in the Jewish reckoning is obviously not a commandment. It is a statement of who God is and what God has already done for Israel. And that one sentence really summarizes most of the Old Testament. Using God's revealed name, I am Yahweh, your God, and reminding us of that God's liberating actions. Actions which are not merely anchored in the past, but are a continuing reality in the lives of God's people. You know, it's easy to miss that. It's easy to miss the plain reading of the text that God didn't just bring those people from long ago out of the land of Egypt. It says God brought you and me out of the land of Egypt and out of bondage. As Christians, we might say with the late Lutheran theologian Robert Jensen, that God is whoever raised Jesus from the dead, having before raised Israel from Egypt. This God brings life out of death, good out of evil, and sets us free. Sometimes we get to see that in dramatic ways in the world around us. I'm grateful, for example, that people in the 1860s saw the end of the institution of slavery throughout the United States, and that people in the 1960s witnessed the civil rights movement. And I hope the shadows of America's original sin that linger in our own time will one day be dispelled by the light of God's love. But I know that even if miraculous shifts like that happen in society, the dissonance between my own life and the words of the Decalogue will remain. It will never go away. That's part of living and breathing and being human. That's part of knowing that we need to be forgiven and embraced and loved. Frederick Buechner's novel Godric takes its title from the name of the main character in that story, who says, "Nothing humans, not a broth of false and true." As one reviewer of the novel, Larry Parsley, puts it, Godric's early life breaks most of the Ten Commandments. But he eventually settles down into the life of a Christian hermit whom people, for some inexplicable reason, seek out for healing. And this is how Parsley's review ends. In Godric's latter days, an obsequious monk named Reginald of Durham is dispatched to write Godric's hagiography. As Reginald tries to pretty up the often ugly past of his subject, he justifies himself, saying, quote, "For the sake of him who is himself the truth, I leave some small truths out." But Godric opposes the literary airbrushing techniques of Reginald at every turn. When Reginald tries to tell Godric that his name is Saxon for God reigns, Godric corrects him and says his name literally means God's wreck. Over the course of reading this book, Parsley writes, "I was struck by my deep and persistent temptation to serve as my own Reginald, to tell stories of my life in such a way that the ugly parts are excised and the good parts are magnified. But in my heart of hearts, I know that I too am God's wreck. Thankfully, though, I am God's. And sometimes, God even moves through me." Now, I don't know about you, but I love the oddly comforting image of being God's wreck. That's something I share with my great-great-great-grandfather, and why it's okay to talk about his life, not as I wish it to be, but as it really was. It's okay for me to be honest with God about my own life, too. And that's the invitation each one of us has received, to bring our true selves to this table, to be fed here, to be loved here, to be forgiven here, knowing that God will one day right all wrongs, those done not only to us, but also by us. This I believe. Amen.